This is the first day of this January 2011 7-day Sesshin, Rohatsu Sesshin. I'm going to go back to one of the texts we use, one of the only two texts we use of Korean Zen, which is the collected works of 12th century Zen master Chinul. Chinul is spelled C-H-I-N-U-L. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. This is a massive and really weighty book. I once reflected on what book I would want. I had to have just one book on a desert island where I was alone. This would be in the running, actually. It is really just full of Buddhist doctrine, Zen teachings. Chinul is considered one of the two great patriarchs of Korean Zen. The other one is from the 7th century. Chinul is from the 12th, which makes him almost a contemporary of Zen Master Dogen in Japan. I'm going to start by reading parts of his biography here, biographical material about him. Well, first, just to get a little historical setting, he was born in 1158, and that was during his lifetime. It was an extremely volatile period in Korean history. There's all kinds of political and military unrest, invasions and rebellions and things that none of us here has ever experienced and ever known in our lifetime. But it was especially so during Chinul's life. In Europe, the universities of Oxford and Cambridge were founded. The Cathedral of Notre Dame was built. St. Francis of Assisi was born. And the Leaning Tower of Pisa was built. Sometimes these Asian masters, the time they lived in can seem so terribly remote and ethereal, and I sometimes like to relate that time to what was going on then in Europe. He's born into a family of the gentry class. Oh, excuse me, this book is translated and edited by Robert Buswell, Jr. He says in his biographical account that from the time he was born, the boy was of weak constitution and plagued by serious illnesses. After repeated attempts to cure him through the conventional medical therapies of the time, his father became desperate and turned to the Buddha. And the father vowed that if his son was cured, he would have him ordained as a monk, as a Buddhist monk. Soon afterward, the illnesses are supposed to have vanished, and Chinul's father kept his vow, had his boy had his head shaved at the age of 7, and he received the precepts at the age of 15, and then became, with that, he became a full monk. He was given the Buddhist name Chinul, Later, he referred to himself as Moguja, which means the ox herder. We're told that young Chinul's relationship with the teacher who ordained him was does not seem to have been particularly close, because his biographer, the official biographer of Chinul, states that he never had a permanent teacher. Now, this is one of the remarkable things about Chinul. He never received Dharma transmission from a recognized teacher in the Zen tradition. This is something that could be pointed out to those who are attached to this myth of this mind-to-mind transition as being, you know, literally unbroken all the way back to the time of the Buddha. As scholars know very well, it's the Chinese who felt compelled to find a lineage that goes back unbroken to the time of the Buddha. And so they made up parts of that. And in truth, they didn't have that system in India, in the Buddha's time. In India, there was no such mind-to-mind transmission, certainly not in any unbroken, continuous line. And I think it's just a matter of time before in this country and other Western countries it becomes widely accepted that people, teachers, are to be known by their merits, their qualifications, and not by their pedigree or supposed pedigree. He was very bright, Chinul was, and he had a natural inclination towards solitude and retreat that had been noticeable since he was young. We're told here he probably felt more comfortable learning to get along on his own considerable talents in seclusion, given the fractious climate of the Buddhist church in his days. From early on in his priesthood, or monkhood rather, Chinul made up for the lack of personal instruction by drawing inspiration from the sutras. So his progress in his practice was based on using sutra instructions to perfect formal Zen practice. By the way, in Korea, the Korean word for Zen is son, S-O-N. But I'll just stick with Zen, the word Zen, rather than using son. So he had a very accommodating attitude toward the written teachings, and this was unusual for Zen students in his time. And he really legitimized the simultaneous study of the sutras with meditation. And this contrasted sharply with the strong sectarian climate of his age. Apparently in Korea, as in China, you made a choice when you became ordained as a Buddhist monk that you'll either be a sutra monk or a meditation monk. And then never the twain shall meet. But Chinul brought these two together, as we will hear more about. After 9 years at his home monastery, in 1182, Chinul traveled to the capital to take the Zen Sangha examinations. Although I don't know quite what, we're not told what those were. My guess is they were primarily academic, regarding your understanding of Buddhist doctrine. Yeah, even there's even a footnote and it doesn't say anything about what it was. Although he passed his tests, he became disgusted with the worldly climate surrounding them. And now his interest in joining the ecclesiastical hierarchy was dampened, and he spoke out about the corrupted state of the Sangha and the need to return to the true practice of a monk's life. He seemed to have struck a responsive chord among some of his fellow monks, and they decided to gather at some future date to form a retreat society dedicated to the development of samadhi and prajna. Samadhi and prajna are a very fundamental dual aspect of practice. Samadhi is the quiescent, the quiescent aspect of practice, and prajna is the insight or awakening aspect of practice. Samadhi is concentration. Prajna is what arises from deep concentration. Another way to understand these two terms is that they are two of the three essentials of Buddhist practice, and the other one being the precepts, sila. And in forming this, or at least committing to form this religious society, Chinuo was the first person to initiate such things in Korea. They became more widely done later on. Before he could form his community, though, there were difficulties that happened in the selection of the site, and these several dozen or so monks who were going to be the founding members of the society were then scattered among many different monasteries. The editor says, although we have no indication what these problems might have been, it seems reasonable to surmise that they were political in nature, resulting from the anti-hierarchical sentiments implicit in the compact. Many monasteries would have been reluctant to harbor a community which seemed to threaten the power of the central ecclesiastical authorities. Buddhism was very much... Very highly organized and all enmeshed with the government at this time. It was a huge structure, somewhat like the Catholic Church, and they would not have wanted a kind of a Buddhist Tea Party to be going off on their own. And then it was to be 8 years before the monks realized this establishment of the Samadhi and Prajna community. But meanwhile, during those 8 years, Chinu was not idle. He wandered throughout Korea, as was the custom at the time, and he finally settled down in the southwest corner of Korea at a place called Chungwan-sa. Sa is the Korean word for temple or monastery. In Japan, it's ji, bukokuji, sogenji, and so forth. In Korea, it's sa, S-A. And while he was staying there, this Chonghwa Sa, he had the first of a series of three awakenings which profoundly affected his attitude toward Buddhist practice. By chance, one day in the study hall, as he was looking through the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, he came across a passage which said, "The self nature of suchness gives rise to thoughts. But even though the six sense faculties see, hear, sense, and know, it is not tainted by the many images. True nature is constantly free and self-reliant." That was the passage he read. And it said he was astonished and overjoyed at gaining what he had never experienced before. And so he got up, he walked around the hall, reflecting on the passage while continuing to recite it. It says his heart, this is from his memorial stele, the big tablet that has a great deal written on it about his life. His heart was satisfied. From that time on, his mind was averse to fame and profit. He wanted only to dwell in seclusion in the mountain ravines. Bearing hardship joyfully, he aspired to the path. He was obsessed with this quest. Notice that we're told that this was an awakening. It sounded like it had quite a profound effect on him that remained the rest of his life. But aspiring to the path. He was obsessed with this quest. This is the best outcome of an initial awakening, is that one, having caught at least a glimpse of the possibilities of full awakening, one is then more committed than ever to really apply oneself and deepen that original insight. It's also unusual, what is called this awakening, because it happened while he was reading. There are other cases of this that we read about in English language texts, but it's quite unusual. More often it's hearing a sound or the words of a master. But this was reading. And it's not it's not that it makes no sense. Reading, or rather thinking, the functioning of the discriminating mind is one of the six senses in Buddhism. The sixth one, in addition to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. And there's no reason any of these six sense gates, as they're called in traditional Buddhist texts, there's no reason why awakening can't be prompted by any sense, including the sense of words and thoughts. It's not the best thing to bank on. His mind must have been empty as he was reading this passage. And if you're thinking, if you're sitting and thinking, then your mind is not empty. So it's definitely the exception to the rule that the awakening would have been triggered by reading. But it seems to have been. And it says here that this experience was Chinul's true initiation into Buddhism. That's another good word for a first Kensho experience, is it's kind of an initiation. In all his future writings, Chinua would stress the need for an initial awakening to the mind nature to ensure the consistent development of practice. So that was his first, what they're calling, awakening. In 1185, he again took up his staff and set off in search of a new environment in which to further his practice. In the autumn of that year, he settled at a mountain temple. And he seems to have been particularly concerned at that time with the continued split between the Zen school and the Sutra school, which was destroying the integrity of the Sangha. He became convinced that the discrepancies between the two streams could be reconciled. Although his primary focus so far had been the special transmission of Zen, that is, the direct experience of awakening, he was positive that the Zen approach could be confirmed in the sutras if he could find the evidence. The validity of both Zen and the sutras would then be verified. So he took up a retreat, began living in a retreat on this mountain, and he said, "I reflected constantly on the Zen saying, 'Mind is Buddha.'" This is a famous Zen line. It's in a koan, at least one koan. And it says, I'm just skipping through this. "Three winters and summers passed before I came upon the simile about," he was reading the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is the root text of another school of Buddhism called the Avatamsaka school, or the Yen school. And in this text, he came upon the metaphor, "One dust mote containing thousands of volumes of sutras." I put the sutra volume on my head in reverence and unwittingly began to weep. However, as I was still unclear about the initial access of faith, which was appropriate for ordinary people of today, I reread another text about the 10 faiths. This is still the Avatamsaka canon. In one part of that, it says, "The difficulties a person encounters in entering into the 10 faiths from the ordinary state are due to the fact that he completely resigns himself to the notion that he is an ordinary person. He is unwilling to accept that his own mind is the Buddha of unmoving wisdom." So let's just rewind that and understand it again. The difficulties the ordinary person has before awakening is that he resigns himself to the idea that he's merely an ordinary person, not an enlightened person in his true nature. "Thereupon I set aside the volume and, breathing a long sigh, said, 'What the world-honored one said with his mouth are the teachings. What the patriarchs transmitted with their minds is Zen. The mouth of the Buddha and the minds of the patriarchs can certainly not be contradictory. How can students of both the Zen and the scholastic schools not plumb the fundamental source, but instead, complacent in their own training, wrongly foment disputes and waste their time? From that time on, I've continued to build my mind of faith and have cultivated, practiced diligently without being lazy. A number of years have already passed. So coming across this in the text was, we're told, was his second awakening experience. And the editor says that Chinul's realization of the fundamental unity of Zen and the sutras led to his subsequent incorporation of YN theory and Zen practice in two later treatises published posthumously. By 1188, it had been over 8 years since the original decision to form the Samadhi and Prajna community, but the monks had still been unable to arrange for a site. Well, then Chinul received a letter from one of the signatories to that compact, the Samadhi and Prajna community compact, and they got together. They found a monastery that accepted them, and he and this other guy invited all the monks who had signed the initial agreement to join them at that temple. Some of the monks had died, others were sick, still others had become entranced with the pursuit of fame and profit. Wonderful phrase. Of the original group of over 10 monks, only 3 or 4 were able to come. The retreat began formally in 1190, and in commemoration of the occasion, Chinul composed his first major work, Encouragement to Practice, the Compact of the Samadhi and Prajna Community. This was a guide to the style of practice which he and his fellow meditators intended to emulate. And we'll be reading from that that document, the Encouragement to Practice, that inaugurated this community. By 1197, 7 years after its formation, the community at that temple had achieved widespread renown and gained a large following among people from all social strata. Although Chinul was still concerned primarily with his personal practice, he had gradually attracted a large number of students. In fact, and this is a quote from the old text, those who were training under him had become like a city. But they outgrew the small temple that they had been using. So he sent one of his disciples into another part of Korea to search for a site for a major meditation center. They found a place called Chapin Mill. Oh, no, sorry. Excuse me. They found the neglected remains of a small temple, not nearly large enough, but they decided to expand on it. It was an excellent site. The site was outstanding and the land fertile. The springs were sweet and the forests abundant. It was truly a place which could be appropriate for cultivating the mind, nourishing the nature, and gathering an assembly and making merit. That's a direct quote, of course. Cultivate. The word cultivate is a direct translation from the Chinese and the Korean. It's the word we use is the word practice, but that's what cultivate means. It's a good word, actually. I keep meaning to work it into our own vocabulary here. It's like cultivating the earth so that it can bring forth life. So they were on their way. This new place that they were building, expanding on, was making good progress in building it. And so he and his companions, on the way there, they stopped at a place called Mount Chiri. This isolated mountain, very conducive to meditation. And he stayed there for a while to deepen his practice. It says that his stele relates that a number of miraculous occurrences took place at the time, so numerous that they could not be recorded in the inscription, which indicated to his companions that he had attained enlightenment. Chino himself relates the progress he made at this Mount Chiri. I'll read that, because this is the third experience of Chino's that grounded his teaching and practice. Since I came from Pomunsa, more than 10 years had passed. Although I was satisfied with the diligence of my cultivation and did not waste my time, I had not yet forsaken passions and views. It was as if my chest were blocked by something, or as if I were dwelling together with an enemy. I went to live on Mount Chiri and found a passage in the records of the Zen master Da Hui, which said, Da Hui is one of the great reformers, one of the great names in Chinese Zen, and we've read from his teachings in Taisho more than a few times. But this is the passage of Da Hui. Zen does not consist in quietude. It does not consist in bustle. It does not involve the activities of daily life. It does not involve logical discrimination. Nevertheless, it is of first importance not to investigate Zen while rejecting quietude or bustle, or rejecting the activities of daily life, or rejecting logical discrimination. If your eyes suddenly open, then Zen is something which exists inside your very own home. And then his only comment, these are Chinul's words, is this: I understood this passage. Naturally, nothing blocked my chest again, and I never again dwelt together with an enemy. From then on, I was at peace. So, if it was an awakening, he certainly understates it. So he seems to have a really remarkable karmic affinity, seems to have had a remarkable karmic affinity with the texts, the written texts, because in all three of these awakening experiences, the texts triggered them. We're told that he was profoundly affected by Da Hui's records, his teaching, which emphasized the shortcut approach of koan practice. And then just to review, the editor here says, Chino's three major spiritual experiences. First, reading the Platform Sutra, next, the Avatamsaka Sutra, and third, the Da Hui's records, which capped them all, guided his subsequent systematization of Buddhist doctrine. These experiences appear in his works as three major approaches to Buddhist practice: the concurrent development of samadhi and prajna, the faith and understanding of the complete and sudden teachings, and the shortcut koan method. And those became his, of course, his very much affected his teaching. So after 3 years at this Mount Chiri, where he had his third awakening, he left and went to the now nearly completed retreat center. It's gotten much bigger. They'd build a great deal now. Shrine, halls, dormitories, kitchen, dining room, storehouses. And finally, after 9 years of work, the reconstruction was completed in 1205. In commemoration of the dedication of it, Chinul wrote an outline of the training rules to be followed by members of the society. And this became known as Admonitions to Beginning Students. And we'll also read from that. This became adopted as the standard of conduct for all Zen monasteries. You see what a profound influence Chinul had on Korean Zen. He based himself there at that new rebuilt monastery until his death in 1210, although he made numerous excursions to hermitages he had built in the surrounding mountains. The community grew rapidly in those years and attracted people from a broad cross-section of the population. The following is recounted on his memorial stele. It was a large and magnificent assembly which included people who had abandoned fame and rank and left behind family to become monks. Also included were royalty, aristocrats, literati, and commoners. There were several hundred of them who had also abandoned fame to enter the community. And then we're told of his training of a successor. I'm not going to take the time to read that. By the time Chinul was 50, he had enough confidence in his successors, his chief disciple, to pass the successorship on to him. So that he could go into permanent retreat at Kyobong, a small hermitage. His two major works by then were all but completed, and he felt that as the major part of his teaching had been transmitted, he could retire from an active teaching role and devote himself to his own practice in solitude. And then there are the details of his death. He apparently anticipated his death a month in advance. He announced to the monks, "I will not be staying much longer in this world to expound the Dharma. Each of you should be vigorous in your practice." He showed signs of illness. He knew that the end was near. It says here, this is more from the old records, he had known in advance. This is supposed to be traditionally a sign of a true enlightened monk. If they knew in advance that they were to die, imminently. And so that's repeated here in this record, that he had known about it in advance. he bathed, put on his ceremonial Dharma robe, and he said, "These eyes are not the eyes of my ancestors. This nose is not the nose of my ancestors. This mouth is not the mouth born of my mother. This tongue is not the tongue born of my mother." He summoned the monks to the hall, had the drum sounded, lit incense, did all the usual formalities at the altar. He said, "The miraculous efficaciousness of the Zen Dharma is inconceivable. Today I have come here because I want to expound it fully to all of you in this assembly. If you ask me clear, unattached questions, this old man will give you clear, unattached answers." Old, he was 52 at the time. He looked to the right and the left, and rubbing his chest with his hands, he said, "The life of this mountain monk is now entirely in all of your hands. You are free to drag me aside or pull me down. Let anyone who has bones and tendons come forward." And then he answered some questions. The record says his words were precise and the meaning detailed. His elocution was unimpaired. And then finally, supported by his staff, he remained sitting immobile and quietly passed away. Okay, that's a natural time to end for the day. We'll resume tomorrow, and now we'll recite the four vows.